Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'll be reading articles from the April-May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy today's programs. We're going to start with this article from the prologue section of the magazine. It's titled, Sweet Dreams, the tangy tale of how America's children learn to squeeze life for all it's worth, by Sonia Anderson. In the fall of 1839, New York City's Apollo Salon hosted a ladies' fair, complete with live music, displays of artisan goods, and, of course, refreshments. As the Daily Herald reported, from the post office to the lemonade stand, bright eyes and smiling faces peered forth, as if heaven had at last been let loose and got a holiday. This rhapsodic description of a sun-kissed feat is also the first recorded mention of that most American of fixtures, the pop-up vendor hawking lemonade. Though today's kids might not know it, their operation is the result of 200 years of sweat and ingenuity. Since lemonade stands first began spreading across the country in the 19th century, they've served as grifters, street hustles, legitimate cash cows, and instruments of charity. They've also become increasingly dominated by pipsqueak entrepreneurs, who thereby learn what one can accomplish through sheer pluck. The American lemonade business began in the mid-1800s, just as at the Industrial Revolution's peak. Lemonade vendors infiltrated New York's thriving street food scene, and some of them were pretty dodgy. One journalist complained of dirty-looking lemonade composed of molasses, vinegar, and water. On the other hand, many New Yorkers praised these new quaffing opportunities. Before, a thirsty soul would have paid 15 cents for a glass in some bar room, the New York Times reported in 1880, whereas now a customer can have a glass of ice-cold lemonade made before his eyes for 5 cents. Back then, though, selling lemonade was a grown-up's business. For one thing, the average child of the era didn't have much time to experiment with entrepreneurship. Daniel Cook, professor of childhood studies at Rutgers University, Camden, says that in many poor families at the time, children were laborers who obeyed, not self-starting retailers. They worked either in industry, as clothing manufacturers, newsies, even miners, or at home tending their family's farm, or caring for siblings. There was no sense of being able to afford 10 to 12 years of non-productive life for a child in the family, like we have now, Cook says. It was only after the turn of the century that the typical lemonade vendor got younger, as upward economic trends led to freer children. In the early 1900s, the Industrial Revolution gave way to the Progressive Era, and with it emerged a new middle class. As job conditions and wages improved, many Americans decamped from cities to the suburbs, where their children had much more space and much more time. Americans became less worried about their children's utility and more attentive to their development and happiness. By 1918, every state had passed laws mandating that children attend school. This meant the emergence of summer vacation, and as children began to seek both pocket change and entertainment, the lemonade stand, offering the chance to play at business, and for a cash reward no less, presented itself as an apt activity. Across the country, kids took up the pitcher, sometimes most charitably. In 1910, the Indianapolis News lauded three young girls whose lemonade sales realized 85 cents for the babies of Cherryvale. In 1915, some children in St. Louis raised $3, around $91 in today's money, during a summer fundraiser for a charity providing milk to poor infants. And by 1921, lemonade stands run by children were a main revenue stream for the event. A widely circulated bedtime tale of the period featured a pair of anthropomorphic young rabbits, Buster and Duster, who set up a lemonade stand in the woods, expecting to earn enough to purchase an automobile, maybe, or an airship. A lemonade stand was capacious enough for dreams of all kinds. Of course, the whole run-by-children thing isn't always conducive to safe practices, and there have been some public health scares over the years. In the 1940s, one little girl accidentally caused a polio outbreak by failing to wash her cups. In more recent years, a dozen young lemonade vendors in states ranging from New York to California made news when local authorities cracked down on their unlicensed driveway businesses. But legislatures have stepped in to mount a hearty defense of the lemonade stand. In recent years, Georgia and Texas both passed laws ensuring that lemonade stands would be free of most regulation. Pennsylvania and New York have called for the same. One state senator grew quite passionate in asserting the need to protect the entrepreneurial dreams of children. The lemonade stand lost some of its practical value over time. Americans can now buy lemonade in bulk at any supermarket or convenience store. It's also not as common anymore. 40% of baby boomers reported running a stand as a child. Today, as Cook says, many parents have pulled their children back from the public sphere for safety concerns. But the lemonade stand remains every American child's birthright. Though most states still require a permit to run one, the public tends collectively to exempt street-side lemonade purveyors from adhering to the law. Not because kids make better lemonade than Minute Maid, but because we want to encourage their dreams. The resulting enterprise, child-run, unlicensed, and tax-free, held on throughout history, becoming a summertime mainstay animated by a sense of heady possibility. When I was a kid, my brother and I ran an annual lemonade stand from the foot of our driveway in Michigan. The cars would pull in from the main road, directed by our taped-up signs, and neighbors bought our Dixie cups, sloshing with powdery lemonade. I preferred the afternoons when we packed up our supplies and walked our change-filled pockets to the drugstore to buy slushies. But sometimes our charitable neighbor would help out, and she usually sealed our hard-earned quarters in an envelope addressed to the Red Cross. I didn't protest. We'd had our fun, all the same. And that completes the article. The title was Sweet Dreams by Sonia Anderson. This accompanying article is titled Citrus Maximus, a partial tour through the juicy precursors to lemonade, again by Sonia Anderson. The first squeeze, humanity's earliest known lemony drink, sprang up around the 10th century in Egypt. Kashkab, spelled Kashkab, was a mix of barley, mint, black pepper, and leaf of citron, a tartar predecessor to the modern lemon. When lemons arrived in North Africa, they became central to the drink, thereafter known as Qatar Mazat, a blend of lemon juice, water, and sugar. Paris. By the mid-17th century, carbonated lemonade was popular in Europe. In France's capital, vendors carried vats of it on their backs, from which they filled glasses for passing pedestrians. As lemonade's popularity rose, these resourceful merchants became so numerous that in 1676 they unionized. Ahead of the scurvy. With the advent of long-distance ocean voyages came scurvy, a deadly affliction caused by a lack of vitamin C. Eventually, Britain came up with a solution. Beginning in 1795, the British Navy commanded its soldiers to drink lemon juice daily, which prevented the malady. Later, while at war with lemons supplying Spain, the Brits switched to lime juice and earned the moniker Limeys. The spirit of abstinence. In the mid-1800s, the American temperance movement latched on to lemonade as a substitute for booze. Lucy Webb Hayes, wife of President Rutherford B. Hayes, one of the movement's most public advocates, earned the nickname Lemonade Lucy after she prohibited all alcohol in the White House, offering visitors fresh lemonade in its place. In the pink. Legend has it that pink lemonade, a popular variation often containing strawberry or raspberry juice, originated at U.S. circuses. The 1912 obituary of Henry E. Alcott, a Chicagoan who joined the circus as a teenager, records that he invented the drink by accident when he inadvertently dropped cinnamon candies into a batch of concession lemonade. In a gnarlier vein, some historians say a vendor once served lemonade he'd made using water, in which a circus performer had just wrung out her crimson tights. And that completes this article titled Citrus Maximus by Sonia Anderson. We'll move now to the sporting arena with this article from the prologue section, Ballpark Figure. Major League Baseball's official historian is expanding our understanding of the game's origins, by Fred Frommer. Baseball, more than any other sport, is grounded in history, built on legend, an enduring portal into the past. So it made certain sense in 1999 when Major League Baseball's ninth commissioner, Bud Selig, created an unusual position in pro sports, ensuring that this most classic of American games would have an official, in-house historian. Selig first tapped the encyclopedic knowledge of Jerome Holtzman, who had just retired as a longtime baseball writer and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times and Chicago Tribune. Holtzman, a Chicago native, held the post until his death in 2008, but it's arguably MLB's second and current official historian, John Thorne, who has truly defined the role, from developing new mathematical ways of understanding the sport to pushing our knowledge of baseball's roots further and further back into the past. Thorne was born in a displaced persons camp in Germany in 1947, the son of Jewish parents from Poland who were conscripted into forced labor after Germany invaded in 1939. The family wound up immigrating to the United States in 1949 when Thorne was still a toddler. As an immigrant, you want to be an American, but more broadly, you want to be part of the team. You want to be part of the group. You want to have some shared endeavor. And baseball seemed to supply that model more than almost anything, Thorne says. He remembers one early baseball experience with glittering clarity. It was an afternoon in 1959 in the Forest Hills section of Queens, New York. He was holding down center field when an opposing batter launched a drive over his head. I turned fully, racing with my back to the infield, stuck out my glove, and the ball landed in it, he recalls. In baseball, I thought anything could happen. Even I could be a hero. Baseball provided an outlet for the young immigrant boy to fit in, not just on the diamond in Queens, but earlier in his Bronx neighborhood. There he would flip baseball cards with other kids toward the wall of his apartment house. The card flipped nearest to the wall won, and Thorne proudly recalls once winning a Jackie Robinson card. Through these routines, Thorne says, I felt a part of something larger than myself, my family, my street. I was one of the gang. Though he was raised in the Bronx, home of the Yankees, Thorne grew up rooting for the Brooklyn Dodgers, largely because of Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier on April 15, 1947, 2 days before Thorne was born. Even as a young boy, keenly conscious of his identity as an immigrant and outsider, he already felt a strong kinship to Robinson. We were brothers under the skin. Thorne's family moved from the Bronx to Queens in 1954, and he soon had dreams of becoming an explorer who might roam the world, unearthing buried treasures, something he would do with striking success as a baseball historian. First, though, Thorne brought his passion for discovery to the study of literary history. For 1 year, beginning in 1968, he pursued a doctorate at Washington University in St. Louis, planning to write his dissertation about George Herbert, the 17th-century English metaphysical poet who Thorne says satisfied an antiquarian bent, the one that would morph into my study of American history and notably baseball. Then in 1969, he had a career epiphany while working on his dissertation. I was having a hard time with the thesis because the Mets were marching to the pennant, he recalls, referring to the Miracle Mets, who would win their first World Series that fall in one of the biggest upsets in sports history. I came to realize that I cared more about the Mets than I did about Herbert or metaphysical poetry. As fate would have it, one of his professors recommended an editorial opening at the New Leader, a biweekly magazine about politics and culture, and Thorne jumped at the chance. He wound up working there as an editor from 1969 to 1972, but it was his next gig, as an editor at Hart Publishing, where his love of baseball finally dovetailed with his professional work. The company asked him to refresh a 1950 book called Big Time Baseball, soon republished as A Century of Baseball Lore, with Thorne as the author. The book, a work of deep and quirky detail, marked the official start of Thorne's personal quest into baseball history. It was a silly little book, written on assignment with a specific mandate to match the style of standing material, Thorne says, but one faintly amusing story after another, it struck me even then, built up into a folklore of both the nation and its favorite pastime. As Thorne pursued deeper historical research into baseball, he also came to redefine its relationship with statistics, often in concert with the pioneering baseball analyst Pete Palmer. Thorne and Palmer shared a passionate belief that advanced stats could help more accurately illuminate a player's performance. One example is what's called Ultimate Zone Rating, which seeks to quantify how many runs a fielder has saved. In 1984, Palmer and Thorne came out with their first book together, The Hidden Game of Baseball, which later statisticians credited with inspiring much of the ensuing statistical revolution by creating sophisticated new ways to measure player performance. In 1989, the duo published Total Baseball, an invaluable book for the pre-internet age that provided exhaustive lists of players' stats dating back to the 19th century. It was a sensation, giving an untold number of American kids reams of statistical treasure to pore over and memorize. Total Baseball is one of several dozen books that Thorne has written, edited, or anthologized. By the time Total Baseball appeared, Thorne and colleague Bill James were becoming rock stars in the growing field of sabermetrics, named for the Society of American Baseball Research, or SABR, which relies on quantifiable evidence to determine which players have the most promise, for example, a high on-base percentage, as well as which plays tend to have lower yields, sacrifice bunts. As the New York Times gushed in 1989, Bill James and John Thorne have popularized, if not revolutionized, the way baseball is viewed and discussed. Over the ensuing decades, Thorne continued to quietly reshape how fans, sports writers, and industry insiders observed, interpreted, and anticipated baseball in books and talks, also appearing as an expert in Ken Burns's mammoth 1994 documentary, Baseball. Then, in 2003, he came upon a most precious piece of buried treasure, the sort he had been seeking since he was a boy, the first known reference to the game called baseball being played in the United States. While researching a book on the origins of the sport, Thorne had chanced upon an 1869 history of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, covering the years 1734 to 1800. The Pittsfield history referred to a 1793 document that mentioned baseball. With prodding from the late Major League pitcher James Boughton, who then lived about 25 miles from Pittsfield, a city librarian, and others looked for the document among the town's council's minutes from the 18th century. After 10 days of searching, they finally found a vintage bylaw that mentioned baseball, which turned out to be from 1791, and which painted the sport in an unflattering light. The Pittsfield law flagged the young game as a nuisance that needed regulating, banning people from playing baseball and other ball games within 80 yards of the new town meeting house to protect the building's windows. The discovery helped vault Thorne to greater fame than before and established him as the expert on almost any question about the game. Increasingly, the early years of baseball became his main area of research and led to his 2011 book, Baseball in the Garden of Eden, The Secret History of the Early Game, an exceptionally thorough work written in a breezy style and filled with innumerably delightful and surprising facts. Among them is his note about ancient forerunners to the game. Bat and ball games go back to the banks of the Nile, nearly 4,500 years ago, in the game Sikr Hamat, or Batting the Ball. In a review, the New York Times concluded that Thorne can probably lay claim to knowing more baseball minutiae than any other living human. Others noticed, too. The year Baseball in the Garden of Eden was published, Selig tapped Thorne as MLB's second official historian. John Thorne has been brilliant, says Selig, who now teaches baseball history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Arizona State. I have a theory that one of the big problems in life is that people don't understand the history of things, Selig says. And if you don't understand the history, how can you understand what's happening, he adds. I can't emphasize enough how much Thorne's expertise has helped on real issues that we were talking about. Today, Thorne's responsibilities include research, writing a blog, and doing media interviews. But his outreach also centrally includes hunting down the answers to queries posed by fans. One regular question is whether Babe Ruth should be credited with 715 home runs or 714. In 1918, playing for the Boston Red Sox, Ruth hit a walk-off homer with one man on base. By modern standards, a home run. Yet before 1920, the game ended when the winning run scored, so Ruth was credited with a measly triple. Thorne will explain this history to fans, along with his opinion that Ruth really did hit 715 homers. Thorne is not afraid to use the modern tools of baseball analytics to take a fresh look at some of the game's other biggest icons, such as Yankees Hall of Famer Joe DiMaggio. On the occasion of DiMaggio's 100th birthday in 2014, Thorne argued that the player wasn't the elite center fielder he's cracked up to be. Appearing on the MLB Network, he said, "If you look at DiMaggio's range factor, he never led the American League, and he never even finished second once." Brian Kinney, a host for the network, pushed back the next day. "I don't want the next generation to think DiMaggio was some sort of fraud, and he was trumped up because he was popular, and he married Marilyn Monroe. This guy from 1936 to 42 was the best player in baseball, quantifiably." Spirited debate is one of the great things about baseball, Thorne says. Only one who has busted myths will recognize their power, their hold on the imagination. Legends command respect, but evidence is good too. That completes the article. The title was Ballpark Figure by Fred Frommer. And that completes the broadcast today. This has been the Smithsonian Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading from the April-May 2024 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. I hope you enjoyed the program. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the Broadcast Info Audio, and then click on Demand. You'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.